is the Lumberman's Mutual versus Reinsurance Results. Mr. Meyer. Mr. Meyer?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm David Meyer. I represent Reinsurance Results, Inc. and its co-owner or sole owner, Mr. Tom Thompson. Mr. Thompson and my client is asking this court to reverse in its entirety the denial of the summary judgment to the defendant, Mr. Thompson, and the granting of a summary judgment to the plaintiff.
Mr. Meyer, in what sense had the additional losses recoverable, identified by RRI, not been processed in accordance with the terms and conditions? Because the problem, as I understand it, was not that ILM had submitted the premiums and claims, that they had been processed incorrectly, but rather that ILM failed to submit them at all due to a deliberate change in its accounting practices.
The contract that is of most importance here between our two parties is their aggregate reinsurance contract. That is a net loss ratio contract, which basically says that the reinsurance company will guarantee that Indiana Lumbermen's will have no greater loss beyond 72.5% of its net premiums. What they did do in the processing error, and you're right at the heart of this matter, the processing error is that when they reported, when Indiana Lumbermen's reported those losses and those premiums to their aggregate reinsurer, they submitted only partial numbers, only part of their actual premiums paid to their earlier or inuring reinsurers. The example would be that they paid approximately $500 in premiums, only recorded, however, a portion, that's a 250. And so they sent up the road to their aggregate the $250 number, which affected that net loss ratio that the aggregate reinsurer was obligated to reimburse them upon. So by not reporting the full amount of those premiums paid to their inuring reinsurers, they effectively altered the amount of money.
They is who?
Indiana Lumbermen's, in their reporting to the aggregate reinsurer.
Yes, but what the contract says is that you're supposed to determine whether any premium or claims have not been processed in accordance with the reinsurance contract terms and conditions. How is this mistake connected with processing in accordance with the contract terms?
Good question. That's exactly the heart of this case. The way in which the insurance company, the plaintiff in this case, and its aggregate reinsurer communicate is on a gentlemanly basis, if you would. The plaintiff would send their report as to what they received in premiums, what they lost or paid in claims, and they would also send up the numbers that reflect the net losses and the net premiums paid. They have to reflect what they had received back from the other reinsurance companies that they dealt with for per risk and property catastrophe losses. That's the net component, Judge, if you would, of that net loss ratio. And on the same basis, they had to report to their aggregate their net premiums, which are the premiums they collected less the premiums that they paid to these inuring reinsurers. By not accurately identifying the total premiums paid on a per-year basis, the denominator portion of that net loss ratio, that 72% of their actual net losses, it was skewed. So the processing error was not reporting to their aggregate true and actual numbers. Tom Thompson, on behalf of Reinsurance Results, came in to do his review, and he analyzed the raw data, all of the premiums received, all of the payments sent out, all of the numbers that went out to the inuring reinsurers, and then he compared that to these annual reports submitted to the aggregate reinsurer. And he discovered that they had failed to process the numbers according to the terms of this net loss ratio contract.
So are you saying that he really did all the work on this before he actually talked to Don Blackwell? Because once he talked to Blackwell, Blackwell said that this practice had been approved by their accountant, Price Waterhouse.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly
so
what
I'm
saying. So
is that your position? Everything was done before he had the conversation?
And I'll refer the court to the December 1st memo from Tom Thompson to Mr. Blackwell, which is two pages, and he says in the first paragraph, "I've discovered an anomaly. You haven't reported the correct amount." Then he goes on for two pages and speculates, well, maybe it's because of the way you changed. And he wasn't sure. He's only into that engagement for a number of days at that point. And then the rest of December, he was about doing the work of trying to determine whether or not that accounting protocol that was adopted in 2000, made retroactive to 1999, was correct accounting practice. There's no question. I'm not running.
So he was, but he was told that they were relying on what Price Waterhouse said.
You know,
right. So in terms of doing his report, I don't know if that's kosher. And I mean, Price, what I mean, we can't rely always on what accounting firms say. But I'm just trying to. When he's told that to stop doing that, I mean, he's told that that's the way they're going to report. It's been approved by the accountant. Why would he continue to work? Why couldn't he just put a footnote in his report that he was going to do and say this group was excluded the request of the company, ILM?
Excellent question, and I think the response, goes to what it is that we're litigating about. Tom Thompson did the raw work, identify this error on his own. Don Blackwell, on December 1st, in response to that memo, said, oh, well, we're processing this way because we've made this accounting protocol change going way back. And at that point, what they discovered, obviously, was the cause of the processing error. It related back. There's no one questioning that. Counsel will not deny that the processing error relates back to an accounting protocol. The issue for us here is the district court found that there was some exclusion, unwritten exclusion, in this one-page, three-paragraph contract that would allow the plaintiff to avoid his financial responsibility and split these net funds on a one-third basis if the error causing the processing issue relates
well,
back
to
the contract.
Well, to make it a simpler case, what if Thompson had discovered that someone in Lumberman's was stealing money from them by misrepresenting what was due from the reinsurers, right? So instead of asking for $1 million, this embezzler would ask for $900,000 and pocket another $100,000, something of that sort. And Thompson discovers that. Would that entitle him to one-third of the recovery from the embezzler?
I'm not sure I follow. Let me ask a question, if I may, Judge. Are you suggesting that in the event, in his review, Tom Thompson discovered
Let me make it extremely simple. So the Lumbermans bills the a reinsurer $1 million, and the reinsurer pays $1 million, but an employee at Lumbermans steals $100,000 from that. And Thompson, in the course of his review, somehow, maybe he talks to the employees, and somehow he discovers the embezzler. Now, is he, and the $100,000 is recovered from the embezzler. Now, would he be entitled to a third of that $100,000?
I don't believe so. And the reason that he would not be is because Mr. Thompson limited his recovery to only those funds that would come back from one of the several reinsurers with which Indiana Lumbermans had a contract.
That's my example.
Right.
So I don't understand your answer.
I thought you asked me, would he get
They got the $1 million from Lumbermans, and then an employee steals it. So Lumbermans actually only receives $900,000. And Thompson discovers this shortfall and is able to recover the $100,000. Now, would that be, and then say, would that entitle him to a third of that $100,000?
If Tom Thompson identified that million in the first place, he's entitled to a percentage of that million. What happens with money once it's received by Indiana's? That is not part of the contract. Mr. Thompson would only be entitled to a contingent fee on what is returned from the...
Well, maybe the money is intercepted on the way back, right?
No, if it's intercepted on the way back, the contract says they have to receive it. You know, if it's lost in the mail, if it's gone, it has to be... I mean, that's an interesting question, I guess. I hadn't thought through that. This focuses on the distinction between the argument that, well, did they find a processing error, or are they just auditing the auditors?
Is it your position that the reinsurance contract itself somehow forbade or made erroneous the accounting change that ILM had adopted? Is that your position?
No. The accounting error is an accounting error because it does not comply with the accountant's standard practices. It's referenced in both briefs as accounting practice 62. Now, that does relate to the reinsurance business, and it relates to at what point is that premium received by an insurance company fully earned. Mr. Thompson said it was fully earned at the end of the year in which it was received. That was later apparently confirmed by the National Accounting Office for the plaintiff, which, by the way, was a necessary step in Indiana Lumbermans getting that refund, those net funds, from their aggregate reinsurer. Had they not made the request, had the money not come back to Indiana Lumbermans, we wouldn't be here. There wouldn't have been a lawsuit. Mr. Thompson's only right to a fee is if there is money collected.
Okay, let me give you a better version of my question.
Okay.
Suppose Indiana Lumbermans bills a reinsurer for $1 million, and the reinsurer says, I'm very sorry, I'm broke, I can't pay you. And in the course of his review, Thompson discovers that actually that reinsurer is not broke, and as a result is able to collect the $1 million. So would he be entitled to that? To a third of that?
Absolutely.
Well, I don't think so, because what you're saying is that you're hiring someone who has, you know, limit. I mean, he has a good resume, but you know, he has a limited specialty, which is the processing of reinsurance claims.
Yes.
Says. I'm looking at his webpage. You know, he's responsible for all phases of reinsurance process, program analysis, design and placement, coordination of all technical servicing responsibilities. But he's not a private detective, right? And so if he goes outside his area of expertise, and whether it goes into accounting or does investigation of the solvency of reinsurers or whatever he does, does this contract commit Lumbermans to give him a third of anything he recovers, even if it's, you know, completely outside of his engagement?
I would respond to that by saying, one, the contract at the reporting paragraph, the center paragraph, limits Mr. Thompson's recovery only to those monies that are ultimately returned that are identified as being processed incorrectly. That's one. Secondly, to the extent that...
So it depends how broadly or narrowly the word processed is interpreted, doesn't it?
Well, I think we use a very common sense concept of process. It is undisputed that the plaintiff had the duty of reporting all of its losses, all of its premiums, and all of the net losses and all of the net premiums to their various aggregate or to the aggregate reinsurer. There's no question of that. In looking at that raw data, Tom Thompson discovered they failed to process according to the terms of that net loss contract. Now, I see my time is up. Do you want me to finish?
No, why don't you, we'll give you a minute after we hear from Mr. Hull. Mr. Hull?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Andy Hull, one of the counsel representing Indiana Lumbermen's in this case. My colleague Jason Falk is with me at counsel table today. This case presents a question of construing a one-page service agreement that was drafted by RRI and Mr. Thompson. That's the task in this case. The service afforded by RRI is a narrow niche service. As the Court has already pointed out by its questions, Mr. Thompson's experience is confined to working for intermediaries, drafting reinsurance contracts, and reviewing the processing of claims, the ceding of claims and premium to reinsurers to determine whether or not that is done in conformity with reinsurance contract terms and conditions.
Forgive me, but as I understand the facts, Mr. Thompson did discover the problem with the unearned premium by reviewing historical data regarding ILM's premiums and discrepancy. Am I right so far?
I'm not sure what he reviewed within a day or two of commencing, but he does identify the statutory accounting position that Indiana Lumbermen's took in 2000 with the approval of its auditor, PwC.
Well, why doesn't that fall within the scope of the sort of historical review that RRI was...
Because the scope of the review is defined by Mr. Thompson in his own contract. It is to determine whether the ceding of reinsurance claims and premium have been processed in accordance with reinsurance contract terms and conditions. That is the touchstone. And to go to your question, Your Honor, the ultimate question here has already been answered, which is there anything about the aggregate excess of loss treaty that compelled Indiana Lumbermen to take a particular statutory accounting position on Schedule P of its financial statements? And counsel for RRI has indicated, no, we agree with that. That makes the point that the statutory reporting position is not compelled by any particular reinsurance contract term or condition.
Well, the accounting change that ILM made was ultimately determined by Price Waterhouse be an improper change, as I understand. And once that was corrected, ILM ceded additional claims to its reinsurer. Why can't that be understood as a processing error that resulted in additional funds collected from ILM's?
The reprocessing occurs because there is a change in the aggregate loss ratio under the aggregate excess of loss treaty. That the definition for that is found in Article 5 of that treaty. And Article 5 of the treaty says you're going to determine the aggregate loss ratio by looking to Schedule P of Indiana Lumbermen's financial statements. And what you will do and what the process is is to simply pluck those numbers from the published financial reports. The treaty itself dictates nothing about how premiums ceded to reinsurers are to be earned or are to be reflected on statutory reports. The parties didn't bargain over that. The process is to go to the financial statement and to take the numbers that are reflect thereon and then perform the calculation.
Lumbermans did get more money from the reinsurers.
They did.
So how did that? How did the change in accounting lead them to get more money under
and
the
then give us the time
the
sequence
contract?
Too? Because at one time, didn't Price Waterhouse approve this practice initially? So give us also the time frame as you answer Judge Posner's question.
In 1999, Indiana Lumbermans was using its what I will call the original accounting policy before the first change. And they billed their aggregate excess of loss reinsurer an additional $1.3 million, which was a real recovery that they enjoyed for the 1999 year. In early 2000, Indiana Lumbermans, with the approval of PwC, decided to create a statutory reporting asset, the unearned ceded premium reserve. And that was a deferral of recognition of earning of premium by reinsurers. It created an asset on the books of Indiana Lumbermans, which benefited its surplus to the tune of a number in excess of $500,000 beyond the reversal of the ceding of claims to the aggregate under the aggregate excess of loss treaty. So what Indiana Lumbermans did was it took the statutory asset intentionally and it pushed away the cash from the reinsurer. It decided to forego the $1.3 million that is really the essence of this case. And it did that intentionally, it did it knowingly, and it did it with the approval of its auditor, and there was nothing about the aggregate excess of loss treaty that dictated either treatment. It was simply a question in the sphere of statutory accounting.
This goes on for 5 years, right?
It does. Unknown to the parties, what happens in effective January 1, 2001, is that there's a statement of statutory reporting principle issued, which calls into question this practice from a statutory reporting perspective. The practice continues on until 2005 when Mr. Thompson raises the issue, and the only issue he's raising is the issue of Indiana Lumberman's statutory reporting position on this unearned ceded premium reserve and the fact that Indiana Lumberman's decided to forego that $1.3 million in 1999. Within 2 days of his commencing, Don Blackwell gives him the spreadsheet, and they have the conversation, which is largely undisputed.
You said within 2 days.
Within 2 days of the contract being executed.
So then the work has not been done.
Work has not been done. The contract is signed on November 29, 2004, and on December 1, 2004, on or about that date, Mr. Thompson points out his discovery of the issue. Mr. Blackwell says, yes, we know about that. We've done that with the benefit of our auditors. We approve of that because it helps our surplus. That's why we've done that. So we have intentionally foregone reinsurance recoveries under the Aggregate Excess of Loss Treaty. It benefits the company. So all of that is explained. Mr. Thompson then goes on to perform what he claimed in his affidavit relative to his quantum merit claim, another 400 hours of work. Related to what? It's really not clear, because everyone admits that the reinsurance issue here, the unwinding that occurs as a result of the change in the statutory reporting policy, is simply to reverse the transaction that Indiana Lumberman's undertook in 2000 when it first made the accounting change. That is all that has occurred. And Mr. Thompson has acknowledged in his deposition, which is part of the record, that Indiana Lumbermans knew this. Indiana Lumbermans could have done the calculation itself. There was nothing hidden. There was nothing discovered. And most importantly, there is nothing that about any of the reinsurance treaties, particularly the aggregate excess of loss treaty, that speaks to the accounting position. It is simply something that is dictated in another sphere. Mr. Thompson is not a CPA. He and his company have undertaken some 22 engagements. In not one, have there been issues of statutory reporting. In the prior engagement of 1999 with Indiana Lumbermans, there was no issue of statutory reporting. He has no expertise in statutory reporting. The service is sold, and it is solicited on the basis of it being a win-win for the reinsurer, that there will be a benefit to the surplus. When you find dollars in the reinsurance recovery business, that's money that goes in the reinsurer's pocket. If there's a processing error, if you didn't get the money, that's money that goes in the insurer's pocket, and it drops to the bottom line. It helps surplus. When you migrate over to the world of statutory reporting and you begin to offer observations in areas in which you were not hired and have no expertise, you affect the surplus in a negative way. The end result of this is that Indiana Lumberman's surplus, before accounting for Mr. Thompson's compensation claim, was adversely affected to the tune of $820,000.
Now, the statutory change, was this based on desire to protect creditors and investors, or was the idea that somehow a company like Indiana Lumbermen's was hurting itself by moving this receipt to surplus, by creating a reserve which postponed
with the initial change?
Yeah.
I think the view of Indiana Lumbermen's was that surplus, particularly for mutual companies, is very important. It's important to rating agencies.
No, I understand how your company thought back in 1999 that by creating the reserve, you were conferring a net benefit on the company. That's fine. My question is, when the propriety of this creation of a reserve was questioned, was it questioned because it might mislead creditors or investors, or were the accountants saying, no, this wouldn't hurt, it wouldn't help you, it wouldn't help the company?
I think the
so it's kind of, is it paternalistic, saying, you know, this kind of accounting maneuver is bad for a company, or is it the more this sort of auditing standard that you're going to be misleading outsiders with this sort of thing?
I think the change in 2005 was required to bring Indiana Lumbermen's in conformity with the statutory reporting principles for purposes of the annual filings that
right.
made
but
the
my,
state
my,
departments of insurance.
But is this because it's something insurance regulators want, creditors want,
insurance
or
regulators.
Companies want?
Insurance regulators.
So this is something regulators want?
Yes. Yes.
So your company would still take the position that if it weren't for that change, it would have preferred to have this reserve
Absolutely.
Rather than the cash from the reinsurers.
Absolutely.
So that's your argument that you derive zero benefit from his discovery. You just had the $800,000 fee. That's your argument.
That's correct. Yeah. It is only the mandate of PwC that the change needed to revert
right.
back in 2005
right.
that dictated Indiana Lumberman's making the change. It would, in a way that might seem unusual to some, it was far preferable to have the statutory reporting asset and the increase to surplus than the cash from the reinsurer.
Of course, you did also say, though, that when you get cash, additional cash from a reinsurer, it goes into surplus, it goes to the bottom line. And so why is it better to have the reserve increasing surplus rather than the cash increasing the surplus?
In this case, they were not the same amounts. The reserve account that was created
was more than the $1.3 million.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
So it was sort of seeded with the $1.3 million?
Yes. Yeah, the reinsurance recovery offset a far larger loss to surplus from the account.
So this is a little like bank reserves. So if they increase their reserve increases their lending limit. Is that it, that somehow if you, that this reserve increased the insurance you could write or something like that?
Yes. That was there are many aspects of operation of mutual insurance companies affected by the amount of surplus, including rating. And so the desire to, in conformity with statutory reporting requirements, to increase the rating as you can by increasing surplus is a keen objective.
So your measured surplus increased by more than the $1.3 million, is
absolutely.
That
absolutely.
That probably is what the regulators object to, right? They didn't want your surplus to be jacked up that much.
Although they truly are unrelated issues. The aggregate excess of loss recovery is a financial reinsurance treaty.
No, I understand. I'm just interested in what the regulators are concerned about.
Ultimately, the
they don't want your surplus to. They're worried about risk. If your surplus is too large, you write more insurance,
yes,
and you may go broke.
Yes.
Okay.
If I might,
yeah,
very
sure,
briefly.
Sure, of course, you have time.
There was also mention of Section 7 of the, or Article 7 of the Aggregate Excess of Loss Treaty in the reply brief by RRI in an attempt to find some provision in the Aggregate Excess of Loss Treaty that was offended by or related to this accounting change. And there's some confusion in that brief that I just wanted to briefly address. Article 7 relates to the amount of premium to be paid by Indiana Lumbermans for the aggregate excess of loss reinsurance coverage. There is no issue about the amount of premium that was paid. The correct amount of premium was remitted by Indiana Lumbermans to the reinsurer, and Mr. Thompson makes no claim for compensation based upon premium. So the Article 7 discussion is really a false issue.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Meyer, your time had expired, but we'll give you a minute.
I appreciate that courtesy. I just wish to make 2 points, if I might. First, back to your question, Judge. Mr. Thompson received that in advance of the signing of the contract on November 29, 2004. And by December 1st, he had done his work. And he did send out a memo, 2 pages long, it's in the record, and it was in response to that memo where Mr. Thompson did not identify an accounting error of this accounting error that counsel is talking about. What he discovered was the reporting error to the aggregate reinsurer. He speculated why it might have been. He had several different theories. It was at that point in response.
Yeah, but hasn't he made a very, he's made, I think, 2 powerful points. So the first is that what you demand from the reinsurer is based on, Lumbermans demands from a reinsurer based on its accounting principles is not really anything to do with the reinsurance contract. And his second point is that there's no real benefit to him from what Thompson did because they liked this reserve business to jack up their surplus. They were forced to change it, by the law regulators, but they haven't benefited at all from your work. How has your work benefited them?
Excellent. There's 2 reasons that they benefited. First, under the contract, if they received net funds, they took a third. There's no question they received over $2.2 million 1 month after Mr. Thompson.
Yeah, but they'd rather have the reserve, right?
Well,
companies and people are constantly trying to throw income into future periods, right?
Right. That's my second point here. That reserve was never an actual true reserve. It was only the result of the imposition of an incorrect, improper accounting mechanism. That was what PricewaterhouseCoopers apparently confirmed. We don't have anything in writing from them. We just assume that. Bottom line is, Indiana Lumbermans wrote a check for $400, only registered on their books $200. But the fact is, $400 was paid. It was gone. They admit in deposition it was never coming back. Mr. Thompson, in addition to getting them the $2.2 million, save them at some point down the road from some other outside regulator coming in and saying you are artificially, improperly propping up your surplus.
Well, then they'd get their money back, right?
No, at that point, now they have problems with a regulator who's saying companies have to show straight books. And if they don't have straight books, now they have problems much bigger than just collecting a few million dollars. Mr. Thompson,
But is he wrong when he said that the company was aware of the problem? If the company was aware of the problem, they'd make a judgment. If we keep this questionable reserve on our books, will that mean that we won't be able to use it to jack up our surplus, but instead, at some point, we'll lose the reserve and we won't be able to get the money back from the reinsurers? If they were thinking in those terms, what did Thompson do for them but accelerate their decision?
I think there's no doubt that in 2000, when they retroactively applied this accounting protocol, this new accounting, ultimately wrong accounting protocol, they did an internal note to themselves. This might have an impact.
Right.
They did that. We acknowledge that. That's what that brief discussion on December 1st was about. Keep in mind, however, Judge, back in early 2000, when this accounting protocol was put in place, the brand new, or relatively new, aggregate reinsurance contract was just starting, and they had not yet received any money. It was only on the paper reserves, because it takes a few years, of course, for claims to come through, be processed with the claimants, and then be paid out. And so money had not yet been paid out by the aggregate reinsurer in 2000. It took a couple years to cycle. So, yes, there was an acknowledgement at one point, but the contract says if there are net funds.
I understand the contract. My question is, according to Mr. Hull, in 2004, late 2004,
right,
when the contract was signed, November 2004,
right. Right.
Lumbermans was aware they had this problem.
You know, I don't know if they were. They had been aware. I think they had been dropped for 4 years and not addressed at all. They had a search round. They found some memo. And they said, oh, yeah, this is what we did back then because, you know, we wanted to have a little better surplus. We think it was the right way to do it. We had some voice acknowledgement from a PricewaterhouseCooper local. And Tom Thompson said, after finding the error, the question from Judge Williams earlier, that's not consistent with the contract. You have to report these losses per year, and that's what they didn't do. Carrying this artificial surplus was contrary to proper accounting principles, as bore out by PricewaterhouseCoopers. I don't think it was a conscious decision on a yearly basis. There's no evidence of that. The only evidence is Blackwell pulled out a memo from sometime in 2000 that said, you know, this might have some impact, and it was forgotten. A reinsurance review finds those things that are set aside and forgotten. Bottom line is, a review of the contract says if you find the money from the aggregate reinsurer and it's collected and it's received, then and only then will there be a payment.
Okay.
That's what we're asking for.
Is your bottom line thought then that you saved them from the jaws? Devils.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but I will say this. At some point, this incorrect accounting mechanism would have caught up to them, and if it took a couple of years, their request to get back this $2.2 million from their aggregate could have been stale, so then they're set with the worst of everything. They get their hands slapped for having improper accounting published on their books, and the aggregate, who had by that time already disbanded that contract, it was not so good for them, they might not have been around to pay them the money.
And I take it you also think Mr. Blackwell's would have been found by government, or they would have to have handed them over. That would have been a problem? Or
Be honest, the mutual insurance companies are not regulated in the same strict method other entities are, and it is possible, to be very honest with you, it might never have been recovered or identified. I want to acknowledge that as honest. But you know what? Right is right. Tom Thompson found a processing error. Don Blackwell said, well, that's because of the accounting protocol we adopted. Tom Thompson then said, well, that accounting protocol is wrong. They spent time, Tom Thompson did work to tell them, and then it was presented to their national office, and the national office agreed. Tom Thompson didn't make a dollar because he audited their auditor. He made a dollar for them and for himself because he found them money. And that's what the contract says, if you find us money. And that helped their surplus by $2.2 million, less the $700 fee that we're entitled to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel. And the court is going to take a 5-minute recess.